Good evening, and welcome to this evening's program hosted by VivaFest and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Marcella Davison Aviles, and I'm the CEO and executive producer of VivaFest. And it's really an honor and a pleasure to introduce our guest speakers tonight, Kat Taylor and Tom Steyer. Kat Taylor has dedicated her life to social justice and environmental health issues. Currently, she's serving as CEO of Beneficial State Bank, a community development financial institution which provides loans and banking services to underserved small businesses and communities in California, Oregon, and Washington. Kat is also the founding director of the Tomcat Ranch Educational Foundation, which is dedicated to sustainable food production through ranching, tours, research, school lunch and garden programs. She graduated from Harvard College and earned her JD MBA from Stanford. Tom Steyer is an investor, philanthropist, and advanced energy advocate. He is president of Next Gen Climate, an organization that acts politically to avert climate disaster and to preserve American prosperity. Before retiring from the private sector, Tom founded and was a senior managing member of Fairlawn Capital Management. Tom serves on Stanford University's Board of Trustees, where he and Kat founded the Tomcat Center for Sustainable Energy and the Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance. He also founded Advanced Energy Economy, which works with businesses to make energy secure, clean, and affordable, and Next Generation, which addresses energy and children's policy issues. And I'll also add that Kat is a trustee of the Harvard Board of Overseers. Tom graduated with honors from Yale University and later received his MBA from Stanford. And moderating this evening's conversation is Dr. Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club of California. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Kat Taylor, Tom Steyer, and Gloria Duffy.
Thank you so much, Marcella. Thank you for collaborating with the Commonwealth Club to bring these wonderful people here to Santa Clara for a conversation. Thanks to you all for attending. We're so pleased to have you both with us. There's so much to cover. You've had such very creative business lives, philanthropic lives, academic lives, involved in the political process. So I'll just jump in, and I'm sure our conversation will take many different directions. Kat, you and I were talking backstage a little bit about how you're involved in hands-on philanthropy. Could you tell us how that differs from how many people participate in philanthropy? What kinds of hands-on philanthropy are you involved in?
Well, I think we made a conscious effort about 10 or 12 years ago to take operating roles in the issues that we cared the most about, which we were able to winnow down in my incredible lack of focus to three: good food, good money, and good energy. Not to say that we don't think grant making is very, very important and we still engage in that, but it seemed important to us to gain the insights of being in decision-making roles in organizations that were trying to produce those three verticals. So we did start a bank, of which I'm currently the CEO. Tom is the chair of the board, and we had the full spectrum experience of chartering a bank on the eve of the financial crisis, going through the crisis, and understanding what it really means to run a push-me-pull-you kind of operation like a bank, and what banking can do. It's a very powerful model, but also what it can't do. So it led to the creation of, for instance, three equity funds to walk through life together. I think Tom can talk with much more clarity about the insights he gained in addressing good energy and climate, about the necessity of being politically active to solve those deep problems. And in the good food side, we run the ranch, which puts us in the shoes of a producer. It is very important to develop sustainable models for producing good food. So that's kind of the gist of our philosophy.
You said that giving grants is important, but what made you decide to go? Is it a temperamental thing that you like to run things and really be involved daily? Or is there another reason you decided to do the hands-on philanthropy as opposed to making grants?
The nice way to say it is that I can be detail-oriented. The bad way, the real way to say it is that I am a bit of a micromanager. So it is a personality fit for me, but it's also life situation. And truly, the insights that you can gain from standing in the place of people really trying to make these big systems work.
Your beneficial state bank, which you're both involved in, tell us a little bit about it, what it does.
Sure. It's a new model of banking. Banking is extremely important. It is what amplifies the money supply of the American economy and the world. It is what facilitates commerce, and when it's done well, it's very, very good, but it can also do a lot of harm. The reason it's so powerful is that it's a leveraged model. We're allowed to collect, at current capital tier one ratios, $9 of deposits for every $1 of equity invested, and our charge is to lend those back out. That leverage creates a lot of power. Finance is really the driving power behind a lot of industries. Second, it's a disciplined, measurable model. It is a business, highly, highly regulated, so we know exactly what we're doing at all times, and that can really help us drive towards impact. And then third, it's a recycling model, so we sure hope that every dollar we lend out comes back, and we get to lend it out again. What we did to create a new beneficial banking model was change the ownership structure. So 100% of the economic rights of the bank are owned by a foundation that is a public charity. It is therefore governed in the public interest, and it removes the natural pressure of a private shareholder to maximize profit at the expense of our other equally important bottom lines. So we are mandated to serve social justice and environmental well-being at the same time that we're financially sustainable. It also means that we create a virtuous cycle of reinvestment because all the profits of the bank must be reinvested into low-income communities that we serve or the environment upon which we depend when they're distributed. So we call this beneficial banking. We attend assiduously to where our loan dollars are. 75% of them have to be in transformative hands. 25% can't be doing anything wrong. And we do a lot of self-examination and certification. So we're a B Corp, a community development financial institution, a social justice labeled organization, a member of the Global Alliance for Banking on Values. A lot of gobbledygook, but it's a new banking model, and we hope it's very impactful directly and influences other regional banks to join this bandwagon.
Which is a point about operating versus more traditional philanthropy, which is if you have a mission for an operating business with a philanthropic point, it better be a mission that's different from the existing institutions. Because what Catherine was describing really doesn't exist at scale in the American banking universe. So not only are you filling a hole, but you're showing that it can be done so that hopefully this will be a medium-sized commercial bank in the United States of America. But in addition, you're saying there is a model here that does take into account social justice and environmental improvement and is profitable, and we're not just talking about it. We can sit here and show you accounting statements that prove it's true.
So you're a very experienced hand in financial institutions, having been the president and CEO of Farallon Capital. So you're the chair of the board of this bank. How did the idea for the bank come about? What's the governance structure like that keeps it on track to this model?
Well, the genesis of the bank actually was Catherine and my trying to figure out what skills we had that could serve the mission that we were talking about, which was social justice and environmental improvement. And since Catherine has the silver-plated resume, having gone to Stanford JD MBA, and I'm a humble MBA, there were a limited number of things that we could appropriately start. And we tried to figure out what's the financial institution that would best serve the broadest community. And in particular, we wanted to do kind of the opposite of what's called redlining, where you get deposits in poor communities and lend them in better off communities. We wanted to try and get the deposits from everywhere and then lend them in the communities that needed the money the most. And the Catherine described a very different ownership structure where it's owned by a foundation, where the mission of the foundation really is, you know, a triple bottom line. But, and of course we have a board of directors like any other bank would. I think actually the difference in terms of sticking to mission and being effective on all of our bottom lines is the CEO. So I'm not just saying this to have peace in home. I actually think this is true. We have the best bank CEO in the United States of America. And we've had three different CEOs. Catherine is our third. And, you know, the ability to do what she's trying to do is very dependent, as every organization is, on leadership. And that flows down to every one of the measurable outcomes and also to morale, mission, hiring. You know, I think Catherine's mantra is the mission is the advantage, that we should be able to attract better people because they want their lives to be meaningful. We should be able to get business because we can honestly say if we're meeting the terms, money's pretty much a commodity in many ways. But if you really have a mission within the community, you can say to other people who care about the community, you should give us this business because you know the money by law is going back in the community. We have no desire to ever pay this out to any shareholder. This will always be reinvested. And so for the sake of everybody, if we meet the terms, you should give us the business. So I really do think, of course, it's always team-oriented. It's always, but great leadership is the thing that makes institutions great.
So I know climate change is one of your very big concerns, as it is for many of us. And you mentioned that the bank has environmentally sound orientation. So in its lending, are there ways that you try to find ways to mitigate climate change? What does the bank do that's environmentally oriented?
So I mentioned that we manage our loan dollars. That's an output metric, but we focus on specific sectors of the economy that we think are delivering environmental resilience, one of which is clean energy, clean tech, recycling, repurposing. You know, we will lend heavily into those areas. We also measure our own corporate practices, so we measure greenhouse gas emissions per FTE, try to drive that down every year, and that which we can't reduce, we mitigate with carbon credits, usually in one of our own deals, which is kind of a nice way to do it. But we're literally trying to jumpstart sectors of the economy that can address, through business models, climate mitigation, climate adaptation, and that is a very important thing to do. But it also looks a lot like a startup often. So we're one of the leading lenders in biogas digestion on dairy property, which is a wonderful closed loop mitigation of dairy waste that actually produces a lot of, produces extra revenue through the tariff in feed of the energy. It produces bedding for the animals. It produces organic compost for the fields. It's kind of a win-win, but when you the first time you look at it, it looks a lot like a startup, and banks are not the appropriate financing vehicle for a startup. So we have to work really hard to cobble together credit enhancements and other subsidies to get those deals done. But that's also why we started the three equity funds, one in early stage companies, growth companies, and special projects. And those equity funds get to look a lot at new energy innovations, which we desperately need, but need to be properly funded by equity risk profile capital, not deposit funding, which we are the shepherds of.
So you mentioned animal biogas. Mm-hmm. What happens at Tomcat Ranch? Is it a ranch in the sense of animal raising?
Yes. It is stacked animal agriculture, and we raise, de-risk, and experiment with new methodologies and old methodologies for livestock. So we are pasture finishing cattle, hogs, turkeys, chickens, rabbits, fish, not exactly pasture finished, but soldier flies, worms, and I left one out.
I like to say we have a cattle ranch. Gets into worm ranching, which is a lot less romantic, I think.
Depends on your perspective.
Exactly. They're very important. They are basically a mimicking of the Serengeti or the Great Plains or the Yukon or the breadbaskets of Eastern Europe. that marvelous animal symphony conducted by nature that builds soil fertility, soil carbon, and soil structure. And you heard that word, soil carbon. That's really important to mitigating climate change. The problem's in the air, in my view, the solution's in the ground. So we are trying to increase soil fertility by the rapid movement of grazing ungulates, ruminants who can turn carbohydrates and sunlight into energy, over grasslands that stimulates the grass cycle and the microbial community underneath. The other animals that partner with them are complements to the manuring, the resourcing, the pasture management, and cutting down pest vectors by eating larvae and so on. You can read about this in a lot of books right now. It's a very exciting theory that's been true for literally millions of years in natural ecosystems, and we're trying to bring it back in a way that also produces a very healthy food for human beings close into food sheds where that food is really needed.
So let me see if I can translate that for the simple-minded who are on my level, which is there is a lot of controversy about raising animals right now. And there's a sense of how much it, you know, trying to figure out how much it contributes to greenhouse gases and whether, in fact, there's a way to do this in a way that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And our thesis has been that the amount of carbon in the soil has been cut in half in the last couple hundred years, and that there is a way to graze animals that mimics nature that would move us back to the carbon in the soil that existed before 1850. Mm-hmm. And we have scientists on site to try and measure it. And Catherine was actually telling me on the drive down here that the first peer-reviewed articles coming out from those scientists to talk about the ability to sequester carbon is part of this process and to show that, you know, I think people have talked a lot and there's a lot of theory, and we're trying to actually measure it so that we can come up with something that could be applicable broadly in the whatever it is 25 million acres in California of grazing land.
That's great. So I was going to ask you, are you modeling this for others? And it sounds like you are doing a lot to spread the word about what you learn from your ranch through journals and so on that others will be able to pick it up.
So we learn first from a lot of others, the Savory Institute, the Holistic Management Institute. This is happening worldwide. We're in a special situation where, because we're in California and near large food markets and with a very literate journalistic community, we can do a lot more broadcasting than others. But it is based on a collaborative of many, many actors trying to establish that this is a good way forward. Broadcast is a term from agriculture about casting seed broadly and richly so that you have good yield.
That's true. So is your ranching organic?
We are not certified organic. We have not done the paperwork to be certified organic, but we acquired the property in 2002, and we do not use any chemical pesticides or herbicides or fertilizers. So we are a fully organic operation that's not certified. We do believe strongly that organic is a very important movement to build worldwide to get toxins out of the system and to build soil fertility. The opposite of organic methodologies, and I'm in favor of integrated pest management and integrated land management, but too much of the pesticide and fertilizer regime has denuded soils and led to a lot of agricultural practices that are pretty harsh on climate and soil health.
I don't know if you're familiar with Howard and Howard Buffett, son and grandson of Warren, who I was in a program with them at the Commonwealth Club, I guess, last year. And they argue that in terms of raising crops, that we can't get there in terms of addressing hunger and so on worldwide while doing organic farming. They sort of dismiss that. I thought that was interesting. They're trying to be responsible farmers and model farming in the U.S. and Africa and so on. But they really dismiss our ability to produce the crops on the level that we need to do by being organic.
Well, I think nature has the best store of ingredients for agriculture. That is where the minerals and nutrients and water lie. organic is not the thing that adds things, it's the things that, it's the strategy that uses what's there. You do not find studies showing that, for instance, GMO use or a high is increasing yields per se, where that's not happening, and organic actually is probably the thing that can feed the world if we can get back to it, in my view. So it's just we might have to agree to disagree about that.
Although I agree with you.
I do believe in smart agriculture. I believe in precision agriculture. I believe in smart hybridization. We've been doing it for decades. I don't believe in interspecies genetic engineering.
I have talked to a bunch of people who are full-time in the agriculture, you know, what I would think of as very broad-scale industrial agriculture, and who express the exact same view. And so I listen to them, and they're actually pretty persuasive in many ways. But there are also a lot of papers that talk about the long-term impacts of that, so that, you know, the compounding. So there is a pretty healthy intellectual debate.
Sure.
I know that I would say that probably is the dominant view in American agriculture right now, for sure. But I've seen some very interesting academic papers by people who are super smart talking about, you know, every single step is smart, but overall it takes you to a place where a lot of the nutrients are gone from the soil.
That's true.
And so I think there is a healthy debate in terms of time frame and, you know, how much, you know, you're going to rely on completely changing the natural ingredients and becoming totally dependent on kind of a test tube crop.
Sure. So we've been talking about actions that one can take at a personal level, and yours is a very magnified personal level with your ranching and the institutes you've founded and so on. But I gather that you've become somewhat involved in politics, trying to move the dial on a much larger societal level through the political process. Could you talk a little bit about what you've been involved in politically, the initiative process in California, and how things work on that level, how you feel you're able to move things that way?
Well, we had been involved together in energy and climate issues starting somewhere in the mid to late 2000s, so around 2007. And I think that it was, you know, the gifts we made through Stanford were really probably the thing that forced me, at least, to think about why this was a big issue and what was possible. And people normally think of the problems in terms of energy and climate as being technological problems, financial problems, and policy problems. And Stanford was really an attempt to address a lot of the technology and see whether it could be the source of, you know, innovation and research and breakthroughs in energy the way it has been in information technology. I think that I got involved originally in politics in 2010 because I co-chaired a No on 23 campaign on the ballot with George Shultz. And I think the reason that I was the co-chair is that everyone else was too intelligent to take the job.
And that was the attempted repeal of
right,
Governor
Schwarzenegger's
climate change.
It was the attempt to repeal our energy. California's energy laws are the most progressive in the world. I genuinely believe that to be true. And there was an attempt to repeal them, some of you might remember. And I think I was about the 100th choice, but the first 99 said no, mostly because there had been a series of fights, political fights on the ballot between energy companies and environmentalists, and traditionally the energy companies had won hands down. And the most recent one had been 2006, where a very well-intentioned individual put up about $70 million of his own dollars and got creamed. And I think a lot of people felt like that wasn't exactly what they were looking to do with their time. And we did get almost 70% of the votes. We got the most votes for any candidate or proposition in 2010 in any place in the United States. But we also learned, we did it very differently. We had completely different messages. We had a different coalition. I think it's only fair to say at Viva Fest, which I try to say as often as possible every place, that the people in California who vote the most and care the most about the environment and about climate are Latinos. They are almost 80% of Latinos think that doing something about climate is extremely or very important. It's complete. The people who actually care and vote on the environment are not who most people expect. And after Latinos, the number two group is Asian Americans, and the third group is African Americans.
Wow.
So we actually went at this election in a very different way, and our message was very different as well. And so we tried to, when you're trying to get people to vote, you're trying to talk about people, not about animals. And so what we tried to understand is, how does this affect the voters and human beings who live in the state of California? And so we had a very different messages in terms of how we talked about it, because it's important to people because of what happens to the people they love and the people they work with. So why politics? I left my job in 2012 to focus on energy and climate. And the reason that I got involved in politics is the same reason that Catherine wanted to run a bank or run a grass-finished beef operation, which is there seemed to be a hole in the system in terms of which needed to be filled. So when we looked at energy and climate, there were amazing organizations on the policy level, and you guys probably know a lot of them. But they're nationwide. They have 40-year histories of doing wonderful work. They have amazing staff. They have deep resources. There was in the choice between operating and giving, there was no reason to try and recreate those organizations, because they're fantastic. And we support a lot of them, or all of them probably, at some time or another. And then in the scientific realm, in terms of climate, it's very hard to think how we're going to do a better job on science than the universities and organizations that exist. And in particular, it didn't seem like there was a lot of scientific doubt left. So what was not there was any political organization dealing with energy and climate in a focused way that was complete. So even the organizations which we all think of as being the leading energy, climate, environmental organizations were more about policy than about politics, even though they did politics as well. And we felt as if somebody had to focus pretty exclusively on politics. And just like the bank seemed like something that didn't exist in the way that it could, it seemed as if there was a hole here. So we went and set out to figure out how are we going to, Catherine and I were at a session setting up our mission, which is to act politically to prevent climate disaster and preserve American prosperity. Because the other thing that's true is we felt as if unless we do this in a way that's good for American people, it's not only never going to happen. It's, from a political standpoint, that is an imperative for us to do this, is to make sure that we're taking care of the human beings who work here and live here along the way, so we're not advocating things that are going to hurt the people that we're actually caring about.
So on your list of urgent to-dos to mitigate, prevent climate change, what's high on the list?
Well, there's an election on the 4th of November that involves a third of the senators, all of the Congress people, 29 governors, and innumerable state senators and representatives. So I would say for the next 56 days, the thing that is going to consume us is the races there where we feel as if there's a very significant spread between the candidates in terms of their stances and beliefs, where the election itself is important in and of itself, and where hopefully it will have national significance.
Back to the bank for a few questions from the audience. Who does your bank loan to? Are you local, national, international?
We serve the three West Coast states, California, Oregon, Washington. We are largely a commercial lender, so we lend mostly between $50,000 and $5.5 million to businesses and nonprofits. Our theory of change is that these business and nonprofit models are what are going to produce the new goods and services of the future. So we look for those that are especially good at producing social justice and environmental well-being. We just launched our second version of a competitive alternative to payday lending. So we do lend to individuals. If you're familiar with payday and other forms of predatory lending, it's the phenomenon of paying much more in finance charges and application fees than you actually get in the dollars that you borrow. So in California, the average $300 payday loan, you pay $1,100 to $1,400 back to borrow $300 over six cycles of reborrowing. It's a terrible, terrible pernicious practice. It isn't good for anybody. And it interferes with our theory of change, which is in addition to providing new goods and services in ecologically sound and socially just ways, we hope we're producing good living wage jobs along the way. And if we allow payday to come siphon off those earnings and therefore destroy the ability of families and communities to build assets, we're going to go backwards. So we're not a policy shop. We're not an advocacy shop. We're a lender. So in combination with an online lender called LendUp, we have launched, or we're participating in loans that rebuild credit and provide emergency cash funding, but create bank customers versus destroying them. So largely what we do is that commercial lending practice to change the sectors we care the most about, consumer lending. We have a number of other initiatives that are important to financial inclusion and a second chance economy, like individual development accounts, aligned affinity credit cards, and so on. But mostly what we do is that lending practice. It's really important to get underwriting right and get loan capital to the businesses and nonprofits that are going to serve a bright future for everybody.
And another question for you about the ranch from mm-hmm. the audience. How do you treat methane in your biogas, especially since Cattle et al., mm-hmm. your urine has methane?
Yeah. So we don't run a dairy operation. The biogas digesting that we support is through the lending that the bank does. And it does handle a lot of the effluent and greenhouse gas emissions of the dairy operations, not everything. Actually, I think the one gas that is they haven't figured out a way to put into the loop is the heat. But it does take the methane into the energy process. Methane is a big controversial issue in even grass-fed cattle operations. Cows do emit methane more from their mouth than the other end. It's part of the rumination process. It is definitely grossly exacerbated in industrial cattle production because of feeding them improper inputs that they can't digest. They're not meant to digest grain or the seed product of a grass. They're meant to digest the grass. But even in a fully grass-finished operation like ours, they do emit methane. We are in the process of doing a full life cycle analysis of our operations, so we'll attempt to get at what the total greenhouse gas, water, other resource footprint of our operations is. It's very lightly studied. It's very hard to find a lot of research on life cycle analysis of industrial processes or organic or fully grass-fed like ours, but we need to get at it. I have heard of but not found yet a study that was hypothesizing that actually some of the methane emitted from grass-fed cattle is reincorporated into the soil's process. That's those microbial communities pulling carbon down into the soil. They need a lot of inputs, and methane is one of them. But to be determined, we're still trying to get at this. And as Tom said, the best thing we can do is operate in an economic way that others could uptake, study it, adapt, and try to produce the results that we can share with others.
So you too have been involved in philanthropy and social causes for quite a while, but it seemed like a few years back you sort of busted out in a way and just decided to go for it and really, you know, create these new institutions, really dedicate yourselves full time in a very concerted way to these particular causes. Was there an aha moment or time in your lives when you just decided, you know, you left Farallon, you just decided, this is it. We've got to dedicate our entire lives to combating climate change and these other goals. And what brought that about?
Why don't you start now?
Well, I don't want to speak for Catherine. I'd say there are a couple things that were going on. One thing that you have to put into the mix is the age of our children. So our youngest son is 20 years old and is a sophomore and took a year off, so he's been gone for roughly almost 2 years. And I think also that there is, speaking personally, I think that maybe as a result of going on the Stanford board, I had a chance to think about broader mission for the university that I was, you know, serving, but and therefore by extension for myself. And I think that, you know, at some point I felt as if an overwhelming urge to go and fill what I thought was this void in terms of trying to address part of the problem. And I mean, I definitely think in all the things we're doing that Catherine's doing and I'm doing, we're part of communities who are working on the problems. So it's not as if we're, you know, in any way, shape, or form acting alone. But I felt as if there was something there that needed more attention and that for whatever reason, I felt driven to give it that attention.
Undoubtedly, life situation changed. So Tom was very busy with Farallon. We were both very busy with raising children. I sat on a lot of boards and I learned a lot. But I think what else changed was just the urgency of the problem set. And in my mind, it is climate change and income disparity that are most worrisome. Climate change is a very short fuse. If you think about the projections of when we'll, you know, 14 years to 2 degrees, climate change, those sorts of things, and the worst income disparity that the country's ever seen coming on the heels of the financial crisis. So it's just time to get really busy. I believe in group power, so that is this collaborative effect, the collective effect that we can all have seems much more feasible all of a sudden.
There are a variety of questions asking for advice about what to do if for people who have similar concerns. So, you know, what would you advise people to do? Where do you suggest other philanthropists put their money to help move the needle on climate change?
I mean, I first have got to say that there are a number of great policy organizations in the United States who have done great work on environmentalism and specifically on climate for years. And, you know, I think you can, depending on which part of that you want to be more involved in, you know, I'm only hesitating to say them because I'll leave someone out, but the NRDC, EDF, CI, the Sierra Club, you know, they're just wonderful organizations with great histories, awesome people, great missions that they've served, you know, diligently and professionally for decades, who I love and who we work with. You know, my sense on this has been that the change, the United States has more climate deniers than the rest of the world put together. And we're less than 5% of the world. So that's not a good fact. There is a huge political fight going on in climate, which is the most partisan issue in the United States of America statistically, but more broadly, and you know, most obviously I would say in gun control, where 92% of Americans wanted there to be background checks on guns, 70% of NRA members wanted there to be background checks on guns, and we do not have background checks on guns. So there's some, you know, I really don't like to tell people what to do with their money, but I will say I think it's really important that we, as American citizens, vote, take back our democracy, make sure, you know, in democracy, your opinion does not matter at all. Your vote matters a great deal. So if you don't vote and have strong opinions, that is not powerful. Your power is in your vote, and people pay an enormous amount of attention to it. And if to the extent you have the time and the ability to be active in a traditional American way, which it turns out is incredibly powerful, which is talking to other citizens about the things you care about, that is amazingly powerful. And that is actually the power that we believe in. So if you were to ask me, I think being involved at this point politically and doing the sort of registering, volunteering, door-to-door, get out the vote, what really counts is delivering people to the polls and getting the voters who care but don't are not organized enough or are not informed enough to know when voting's going to happen to show up there. And so that is actually, if we can do that in the United States of America effectively, then that will be the lever to raise this big boulder and win. And I think that that is my analysis of how people in general, it starts with a vote, and to the extent you can bring more votes, that is the thing that's going to make the difference.
I just wanted to add to the opportunity, because I definitely agree that voting and getting out the vote is really, really essential. But what we leave out of our personal narrative is what you find interesting, what raises your passion, what you feel you can be constructive at, what gives you flow in the psychological self. That's really important. And the menu is quite broad. From my mother, from a very early age, was involved with curiosity, and that is her passion life. It's a wonderful science learning center on the peninsula. Other people care so much about the food system because it is now responsible for half of the world's global greenhouse gas emissions. Some people care deeply about the correction system because the result of gross income disparity is the over-incarceration of Americans. It's just sort of like, what gets you going every morning? Because if you're going to do it really seriously, it's going to challenge you at times. And so you better be really committed to it so you can get through the times when it's not so fun.
And let me say one thing about what Catherine is inherently saying, which is, you know, we were laughing in the office today about how grim sometimes people are about climate. And actually, this is, from my analysis, what Catherine said is exactly right. This is the greatest opportunity to contribute in American society that I've seen for me in my lifetime. And I don't see why I'm different from the other 317 million Americans. If we can I had lunch yesterday with a pal who was telling me how he thought this was going to work and that actually we would get to a place where we were carbon neutral by 2045. And I was like, if we can do that, we will be so proud of ourselves. That will be such a gas all the way along the line. Mm-hmm. We can have so much fun doing that. And that, honest, I think we've got to get to that place where we feel like, you know what? This is a huge opportunity for us to contribute and have fun and prove our mettle. And that is, we should all be grateful, not pitying ourselves, but grateful for the chance to have that pleasure.
That does sound like totally crazy people, but I was thinking that I was raised in a zero population activist family in Paul Ehrlich, and I know what population pressures are and everything, but I also think it's a weird filter when you look at the fact that we are close to 9 billion people on the planet as a problem. That also means there are 9 billion people who could do something about it. That's pretty exciting to have that larger community. So
that's a wonderful cup half full, glass half full approach, which I share. Here's a slightly more complicated question. Do you have any advice for someone who would like to make climate change activism their life's work full time and also receive paid compensation so they can continue to live in the Bay Area? Any advice would be welcome. So I guess that goes to what the private sector can do, okay. And can you have a paying job in the private sector?
So it really depends what your skill set is. Because our argument is, in order for this to work, there is going to be enormous job creation on a industrial side. That they're going to be, and there are also going to be lots of opportunities for research and science and technology. So the real question that I would ask is, we try to think, the reason we called our organization the terrible name of Advanced Energy Economy is we were thinking about the internet economy. And we were saying, You know, I can remember back in 1996, and I was talking to a friend of mine who was a venture capitalist, and I said, I referred to an internet company. And he goes, Tom, don't ever say that. That's so stupid. Do you refer to Exxon as an electricity company because they turn the lights on in the morning? The internet is a tool for people to do things. And you've, and that's, and I, the reason we call it advanced energy economy is every company has got to see the world through a different lens. So that if you really want to be involved in climate change, the question is, how are you going to use that lens for your particular skills and interests? Because you're going to have particular expertise, and you're going to have to figure out how is, you know, how are you going to develop that? And it, you can do it as a banker by focusing on those industries. You can do it as a researcher. You can do it by, you know, writing good software for the grid. There's a lot of opportunity. You just have to sit there and really ask yourself, what are your skills, what are your interests, and how can I use that lens to adapt them?
So this is not just because I work for one, but I think the promise of social enterprise is enormous. Business is the best optimization model that there is. We've had it optimizing to dumb rules. We need to change the rules so we get the outcomes we want. But there are whole communities. The B Corporation community now is over 1,000 companies. There's social enterprise all over the place. And that's where you get paid to work doing something that matters and moving the needle on these very important goals. So I think there's actually more opportunity now to have a sustainable role in social change than there was before because of that business movement.
So I'm going to ask a question that comes from, I think, someone I know. Electricity-powered rail transport uses less than one-tenth of the CO2 per passenger mile as conventional transport. Yet U.S. Petroleum and short-hop airlines seem to be winning the national battle, having stopped high-speed rail in Texas, Florida, Ohio, and Wisconsin. How can that be turned around, as in California? So high-speed rail, why does it have so much difficulty as it has here in California?
So can I reinterpret that question overtly
Please.
As opposed to covertly? I mean, the question that I ask, and I've thought a little bit about high-speed rail, and I've been tutored about it just enough to be dangerous in terms of going from San Francisco to L.A. and going through, you know, through all the different stops. The place where I see massive need for rail to replace traditional transportation, e.g. cars, is, like, you know, public transportation, light rail, so people can commute differently. And it seems to me to be, I look, you know, just driving down here at the number of cars on the road, the way that cities are organized, is it really possible that that's not going to change and that we're going to all use electric cars? To me, I get the point. If you look at where it is from New York to D.C., from, I guess, Boston, New York, D.C., it actually seems to work really well. But yeah, I really question if we're going to get the huge change we want, are we going to have to do it more close in, really extensions of BART, in effect, from the standpoint. And I know that how difficult that's going to be, but when we talk about jobs, and a lot of jobs, and putting people to work in well-paid jobs in the United States of America, as complicated as it's going to be from a political and logistical standpoint, are we really not going to have to do that and reconfigure our cities so that they work better from that standpoint? Seems, I'd be surprised if we don't.
So you are residents of San Francisco and Silicon Valley, and you grew up on the peninsula and so on. I live about 3 blocks from here, but I work in San Francisco every day. And we're very aware of this debate about the haves and the have-nots, the Google buses, the income disparities. What's your take on that whole debate, where it's become, of course, in San Francisco, rather dramatic debate about San Francisco moving towards only being able to have housing affordable by high-tech professionals and so on? Where do you fall in that debate? What do you take from that debate?
I'm not sure I feel terribly well qualified to address that debate. We do have a strong commitment at the bank and elsewhere to living wage economies, and we support minimum wage efforts. We decry the socialization of cost of large corporates hiring much more than the majority of their workers on a part-time, unbenefited basis. It's just not part of the social compact to me. I do think there are really rough adjustments in booms, and the technology boom now is huge. There are beneficiaries too. I mean, Oakland is, you know, the housing market is recovering a lot faster in Oakland because of pressure, but the winds are very uneven, and it's our commitment to try to make sure that we have broad financial and economic inclusion. And we just work with a lot of groups, unions, all sorts of organizations to try to make sure we bring everybody along to the new economy.
And I think, you know, the original name for our bank before we expanded to Oregon and Washington was One California Bank. And the idea behind that name was that we all live in One California. And I think it is misguided to think that we can have a successful society where a fraction of the society does very well and the rest of the society does not do well. That seems to me to be, it's just not going to work. It's never worked, and it's not what America's about. So we're strongly in the favor, and I see it in the politics, and I think Catherine sees it in the economics of Oakland. We're strongly arguing that, you know, the human interests of Americans are the thing that is going to make us succeed. The human interests and the human capacities of Americans is what's going to make us succeed, and that we have to recognize in each other the strengths and the value that we all bring, and that that is actually the way we will have a successful society that we will actually get a huge kick out of. That it'll be enormous fun when we get back. I think somehow we've drifted away from that sort of image of ourselves. And I think getting back to it is something that, you know, will be incredibly fun, and people will wonder why we ever drifted away from it.
So should San Francisco be building low-income housing? I mean, there's come to be this debate about, you know, building along the waterfront and changing the historic feel of San Francisco, or building large numbers of lower-income housing. And, you know, the issue of real estate rentals being priced out of the, you know, the grasp of most of the young tech workers who want to live there, and so on. So do you think, how should governments respond to this?
So there are very few places. I don't know how many of you guys live in San Francisco, or even, I said everything's local. I'm not sure how many of you who live down the peninsula care that much, but just so you know, there are only a couple places in San Francisco where there's an opportunity to build large-scale housing of any kind. One of them is Hunters Point. And they're going to build, I think, 30,000 units in Hunters Point. And a bunch of them, I think, and I expect and hope, will be, you know, affordable housing. Because the idea that we wouldn't have zoning in San Francisco, which is really what affordable housing is making sure that, you know, making some decisions for the community. I don't think we'll have the community that we want. I don't think we'll have the city that we want unless it is, you know, includes lots of people, different incomes, different backgrounds, and that will make the, you know, what goes on in San Francisco a hell of a lot more fun. And so I think they're going to do that. I think actually Mayor Lee was a, you know, a housing advocate before he was a elected official. And so I think he's pretty much on that, but I'm glad he's on it.
I think it's environmentally sensible to build a lot more infill housing. There's really interesting innovation in housing for frugal footprint or a pod mincer that people are choosing, maybe because of housing pressure, but maybe also because of lifestyle choices, that a less materialistic, more experiential desire in housing. I believe strongly that we have to maintain the mix of housing in cities, affordability being really, really important right now. And the perception of mobility, that there's housing stock to move to, and that anyone can live in any city. It's very tough in San Francisco right now, I agree, but I hope there's a lot more low-income housing development.
So you talked about the importance of people voting and working in the political process. Would you either ever run for public office, take a much more direct role in the political process. I think you'd both be terrific political leaders.
So I know you guys want Catherine to run, and I'm strongly in favor of it as well. You know, what we've always said was, if there was a reason to do it where it wasn't, you know, to pad our resumes, but there was we felt that there was some reason to do it that would accomplish a goal, that we'd consider it. But I think at this point, you know, I would have to say both of us are fairly fully engaged. Would you not say, Catherine Taylor?
Totally. And the way I look at life is, I'm supposed to do the next thing that's required of me every day. Then that's what I should be doing.
Last question, I'm afraid. Who's the climate change presidential candidate that you see ahead?
Who is the climate change presidential candidate?
Or who would you like to see, even if...
Well, I don't want to prejudge what the campaign policies will be of either party. I'm highly confident that the Republicans will come out with a pro climate change, you know, very progressive policy platform, which will give us a chance to get behind them 100%.
Okay.
No, you can't tell. Because, you know, every one of these candidates has a chance to be a leader and make themselves a hero. And if they will do it, we will support them. So I don't...
You're here. And actually, I never venture any political opinions, but I will say, having grown up in California, the Republican Party was the environmental party. This was a legendary, innovative Republican Party that generated a lot of the most important environmental legislation, and so it's theirs to take back.
And every single major environmental legislation on the federal level has come under a Republican administration with Republican leadership. So as much as I was teasing a little bit, I shouldn't be so flip. The fact of the matter is, what Catherine said is true. Right back to Teddy Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln, Republicans have traditionally done that, and we would totally welcome their stepping back and reclaiming their position.
My thanks to you. I know Marcella is going to come back and close the program. Thank you not only for being here, but for everything you're doing as super good citizens.
Well, I also want to echo Gloria's words and sentiments. This has been a very insightful, compelling, astute evening of conversation, and I hope everyone here not only enjoyed it, but learned it and has something here and here to take with them tonight. That's what we try to do at Viva Fest with these types of events, and I know that that's what the good people at the Commonwealth Club do every day. So I hope you enjoyed this evening that was brought to you by Viva Fest and Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. And again, we'd like to thank Kat Taylor, and CEO of Beneficial State Bank, and Tom Steyer, President of NextGen Climate, and Dr. Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those of you joining us on the radio. And it would be nice if it was on the radio, but on the radio. And now this meeting is concluded. Thank you so much.